Now, one response to that documentary might be, what a terrible thing that there's commercial companies like parasites on government schools. Another one might be just to say, how tragic and ironic that so much time and effort was spent to make that documentary without apparently noticing, giving any acknowledgement to the true purposes of school. The third response would be to say, that program shows just how much parasitic activity occurs on the back of schools, which are themselves destructive to what is of real value, thus making clear just how much of the so-called productive economy we could easily do without. I say easily, I'm talking from a human perspective, not from a hierarchical corporate perspective. As John Taylor Gatto warns, it wouldn't be the world we live in now if we ditched compulsion schooling. Pretty soon, people would find themselves not following orders that they didn't agree with. That is my vision of the future, and as energy becomes increasingly tight, so does food, that will, I believe, have a unique ability to focus people on what is really important. As I make this documentary, the Bangladesh slum in which I live is resounding with cheers from people about Bangladesh cricket teams. Now, cricket's a fine game, I'm sure, but as Chomsky reminded us in episode 536, it's not really of ultimate importance, so the fact that people are encouraged to pay a lot of attention to it highlights that it's another area by which people's thoughts and intentions are manipulated. The Bangladesh government really excelled itself actually giving a national holiday because Bangladesh was hosting the World Cup. Now, I didn't complain about the holiday, but it makes the point that there's certainly room for discussion how much of what people think is important because it comes from inside them and how much is externally motivated, which has got to be bad for people's mental health. I see an intimate connection between the huge rise in depression and the rise in forced schooling, the rise in people being prepared, in essence, for lives they don't want to lead. Now we're going to hear from Maya Salovitz, who's written a book about what she calls the troubled teen industry. This is from June last year.
Ms. Salovitz, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Well, why don't we start out with maybe you're telling us what the troubled teen industry is and what got you interested in this area.
Sure. Well, the troubled teen industry is what I call a collection of organizations that provide residential programs for teenagers that take a tough love approach. And these programs are characterized by unskilled staff, very little regulation, and lots of internet advertising. So they might be called wilderness programs, they might be called boot camps, they might be called emotional growth boarding schools, they might be called academies. They're basically called whatever they can name them that will exempt them from regulation. And in terms of how I got interested, I basically was a drug addict in my late teens and early 20s, and I remember reading about these tough love programs as they apply to drug addiction, and I was like, wow, like my fears about people and socializing and being okay were what drove my addiction. So I was kind of like, if people are going to scream at me and humiliate me and attack me, that's going to make me want to get high, not want to get clean. So what on earth is this? And I better avoid treatment. So I'm sure I'm not alone in having had those thoughts. And when I got clean, I just thought, oh my God, I've got to figure out, like, what is it that leads people to have this misguided idea of what would help, and why is this still so popular?
And you mentioned that they were characterized by a tough love approach, and to some degree, I guess that's intuitive, but can you say a little more about what that looks like in practice?
Sure. I mean, the basic idea is that we need to break people in order to fix them. And so the programs will completely isolate the person from the outside world. No letters, no phone calls, no internet, no contact with anybody, even the parents. And they will completely control the environment such that the person gets very little sleep, doesn't get very much food, either gets no exercise or gets way too much, And then the sort of primary characteristic is the emotional atmosphere, which is all about fear and humiliation and emotional attacks. So it's basically designed to break you down using whatever techniques they can.
And how prevalent are these programs at this point in time? Do you have any sense of that?
Well, this is kind of interesting. It's impossible to know because there's no regulations, but there's, at any given time, it's a pretty good guess that there's several hundred of these operating. I mean, if you just sort of count them online, that's about what you come up with. And each of them can hold anywhere from 3 to several hundred kids. So basically, you're talking 10 to 20,000 kids in these particular programs at any given time. There are also legitimately licensed addiction treatment programs that use these same tactics, despite regulation. Those account for some other cases as well.
In your list of the different types of titles that these programs might use, one was wilderness programs. My first question is, are they really the same kind of program, just with different titles, or do they have slightly different bents?
They really are quite the same. There are certainly some wilderness programs that do use credentialed therapists and that attempt not to have this kind of oppressive atmosphere. But the problem is that staff turnover tends to be very high, and the industry is pervaded with this philosophy. So even the so-called good programs will ignore kids' complaints and say, oh, that child is just manipulating, you know, she really doesn't have a health problem. And kids have died as a result of that. So it's possible that there are one or two that are genuinely good and that don't have any of this stuff in them, but good luck finding them because they all claim that and there's no regulation.
And you mentioned that they all claim to be effective. In your research, were you able to come across any good empirical or peer-reviewed literature on the outcomes of these programs?
No, there is none whatsoever. And to me, given that there have been deaths and there's no proof of efficacy, this is why I can't recommend them to anybody.
Any ideas what these programs cost?
A lot of money. They can range from a couple thousand a month. One of them that I investigated recently was charging $7,000 a month. They are very, very expensive. And what's amazing is that this allows enormous profits because if you think about it, if you're running a wilderness program, you don't even need to have a facility. If you're paying your staff minimum wage, that's not a big expense either. And yet you're charging several hundred dollars a day for this service.
Does insurance cover any of these programs?
Occasionally, it will cover some of them. I haven't looked at that very closely, but I do know that some people have gotten reimbursed for insurance in some of these ones that are licensed by some state. You know, some states have attempted to regulate them following deaths, Utah most notoriously, but Utah continued to have deaths after they regulated them, and they basically have one regulator for several hundred programs. And the other problem with regulating wilderness programs is that the best way to regulate something is to be able to do surprise inspection. It's very hard to do a surprise inspection if they have to tell you where they are before you can inspect them.
Do you have any ideas on how these might be better regulated, or would you like to just see them close
up? I don't think there's any justification for these programs until you can prove that they work. So as far as I'm concerned, they should be considered experimental, and the only programs that should be done should be in the context of a randomized trial. I also think that the wilderness itself can probably be tremendously healing for the right kid. And what I do say to parents who have those kinds of kids is that if your kid is not doing so well and they feel like they want a challenge and, you know, they are interested in the outdoors, send them to Outward Bound. Not the Outward Bound for troubled kids, but the Outward Bound for regular kids. Because that way you aren't isolating them with a group of other kids who are stigmatized as being bad kids, who may well indeed be teaching your kids things that you probably didn't intend to have them be taught. And also then if they complain, if something goes wrong, nobody's going to not believe them because they are ordinary kids who volunteered to go there. The thing that I think people forget when they think about what is therapeutic and what isn't is that it's an enormous difference to take on the challenge of, say, something like Mount Everest by choosing to do that. If I choose to climb Mount Everest, I'm choosing to put myself through all these risks and, you know, set this goal for myself. If I'm forced to climb Mount Everest, that's basically torture. And the physiology of your stress response is completely different when you're in a situation where you feel safe and in control and are choosing to take on a challenge versus having no control and feeling completely unsafe. And these programs create those kinds of conditions, and we know that those are the conditions that are risky for creating post-traumatic stress disorder.
In the lead-up to that, or the beginning of your answer there, you said something I think is pretty important, and I know there's a literature on this. I know you've written about this, and I'm wondering if you can elaborate, and that is sort of that actually one of the worst things you can do is put problem behavior folks together in the same place.
Yeah. Basically, we know from neuroscience and sociology and a lot of other disciplines that people copy each other. We have neurons specially in order to allow us to do that, and these are very good neurons because they allow us to empathize with each other. But they also mean that if you put your kid in a deviant peer group, they're likely to copy stuff that we probably wouldn't want them to copy. And if they are in a peer group that's norms are more ordinary, their behavior will tend to be less extreme. So concentrating troubled kids together in itself has been shown to make them worse. And this is something that I try to tell parents, particularly who are worried about, oh, my kid is like smoking pot and drinking on the weekends. Well, 70 to 80% of kids are going to be doing that. And if you take that child and put them in with a bunch of heroin injectors and cocaine smokers, that's not what you want to be teaching them, especially since most of these programs and most of the, unfortunately, legitimate addiction programs will tell all the kids who are in there that they are addicts and they have to go to 12-step meetings for the rest of their lives because they have a chronic relapsing disease. And since most of those kids, we actually don't know whether or not they're addicts, that can become a self-fulfilling prophecy. So you have sort of two different things going on. You have the pure contagion stuff going on, and you have labeling going on. So the best treatment for somebody who has, you know, a mild problem, let's say somebody is, you know, smoking pot and their grades are going down and they are not very happy and things are not going well and they're not getting along with their parents, counseling on an outpatient basis does not put them in touch with more deviant peers. And if you get somebody who knows how to work with teenagers well, they can help them figure out their own reasons why this might not be such a good idea. And people do way better when they're motivated by their own reasons for doing things rather than, oh, I have to do this to please my parents.
And what would you say to parents who maybe have a child that's doing more than just smoking a little bit of pot? Let's say the behavior's pretty extreme, or at least their perception is that it's very extreme, and they feel that they've been to individual therapy, they've tried family therapy, and are looking at this as the last option.
Right. I actually think family therapy should be given another try in that circumstance, unless the person is immediately a danger to themselves or others. I think residential treatment, we have no evidence that it helps. And, you know, we certainly have evidence that it can do harm. So the only reason to lock someone away from people is if they are in immediate danger to themselves and others and need medication stabilization. So if you're going to put your kid in something residential, it should be a psychiatric hospital. It should be a licensed facility. It should be a facility that allows you to visit whenever you want, that encourages contact between you and the child, that does everything to welcome you, and that does everything to empower the child and get them out of there as quickly as possible. There are certainly circumstances where people who have very severe disabilities or children who have been in multiple foster homes and nobody will take them will have to be in some kind of residential setting for a while, but those are the rare cases. And so you may need respite, but that's a different circumstance than treating the kid to help the kid. And a very sad thing about our system is that we really don't have the kinds of resources that we should have in order to help the children who do have really severe problems. But we know that this stuff isn't especially helpful, basically, and that in these facilities, there's as much risk as there is outside them. You know, and people just think, well, oh, if we just lock them up, at least they'll be safe. The problem is if you lock them up with unqualified staff and they can't talk to the outside world, they're not going to be safe because they can't complain if they're being abused. And who's going to work in these places for minimum wage?
Would I be correct in assuming that much of the marketing that these places do is in the form of anecdotes and testimonials rather than, well, I guess there is an absence of peer-reviewed literature. They can't be relying on that.
That's right. I mean, Aspen Education happily promotes a non-controlled study that they did, of their facilities that, had some kind of insanely high dropout rate in terms of following up people. So, it's got pretty much every methodological flaw you would not want to see in a study. So they will make that claim. But, ask them if it's been peer-reviewed, ask them if it's been published in the literature. No. So, yes, they have these very moving testimonials from both kids and parents who've been through this. And, if you watch them, you would think, oh, my God, this is great. The problem is that you can find those same exact testimonials for completely quackish cancer cures that have killed people. And it's human beings are susceptible to stories. I'm a writer, I know this, and I think stories have a very good power that should be used, but you should use the stories to illustrate, what we know works, not just to make claims about something you're trying to sell.
And I think that's a real hang-up for a lot of parents, is they are very moved by these testimonials and don't often understand why controlled studies are so important. And I know you've just been commenting on the importance of that. I wonder if you could, what would you say, anything else to parents about that, about why that is so important?
Sure. I mean, the reason that medicine has advanced the way it did in the last, 100 years or so is really down to the controlled clinical trial. And we do these studies, and they're done in this way because that's the only way to get rid of extraneous variables that can make things look like they work. One of the things that classically is done to inflate success rates for addiction treatment has been to say, we have a 90% success rate with graduates. They don't mention that 80% drop out in the first 2 weeks. So that's one thing that obviously can, there's all kinds of things that can make something look successful that, aren't real factors and that don't prove that it actually works. The only way you can really tell if something works is to compare it to someone who did not get that treatment. And the thing that people also really forget about teenagers and about treatment for teenagers is that simply naturally over time, teenagers grow up. And so an enormous amount of the success attributed to the treatment is actually simple maturity. So again, that's another reason you really need a controlled trial to see if these kids are getting better because they're growing up or they're getting better because of what's going on in the treatment. So it's really important to look for data and to realize what can be hidden if there is not research.
You've done a really good job discussing some of the ways that these programs might be harmful. In particular, you talked at length about the peer deviancy training. I'm imagining that a lot of parents and concerned others may think to themselves, well, even if it doesn't work, it certainly can't hurt, or we're willing to take the risk of them being around these deviant peers. Are there other ways that these treatments might hurt?
Well, yes, and one of the biggest risks, there's several risks. The first one is that one of the few things we know successfully helps counter addiction in the long term is education. People who have been through college, if they become addicted, they're much more likely to recover. So if you spend the college fund on one of these programs, which often is what happens, your child is going to, A, get a much worse education within the program, and B, not be able to afford as good a college as they can get. So right there, you've got a harm that a lot of people don't think about. The other harm that is quite significant is if they get abused in treatment. Now, all of this treatment involves emotional abuse because it's all about confrontation, humiliation, and, making kids feel horrible about themselves. The idea is afterwards that they're going to build them up again, but that is often just not done. And we know very well how to break people, but we don't really know very well how to fix them. So all that stuff where you are attacking and humiliating and basically lowering their self-esteem is, obviously not good for you. And what's also bad about it is that it can produce this kind of extreme uncontrollable stress is a trigger for all kinds of genetic predispositions. So if your kid has any kind of predisposition to depression or anxiety or really anything, even psychotic disorders, they can be worsened by extreme stress. And of course, these things can create post-traumatic stress disorder in themselves, and that doubles your risk of addiction. So there is a real danger of not only doing harm, but of actually increasing the risk of the thing you're actually trying to prevent. I mean, it's really sad, because most of the parents that I have spoken with, an overwhelming majority of them, they really want to do the right thing. They were really concerned about their kids. They checked things out. They thought they were doing the right thing, and they were taken in by these guys. And the fact is that the government does not protect you from this stuff. We don't have an FDA for behavioral health, and we don't have very good enforcement on advertising. One of the things that has astonished me for a long time is that psychologists and psychiatrists have just acquiesced and let these amateurs take over the language of therapy and advertise as being able to treat conditions like addictions and bipolar and all kinds of other things that they have no, you know, qualifications to be able to treat. Like, if I go out and claim that I can cure cancer, I'm not allowed to do that. But I can go out and claim that I can cure depression and ADD and all kinds of other things in my wilderness program, and psychologists and psychiatrists will go ahead and refer people to it.
Do they ever make the argument, and I don't know, I'm just speculating, that, well, maybe they have one licensed person on staff, or they had some licensed person design some aspect of the program or anything like that, and then a bunch of paraprofessionals, or?
Oh, sure. I mean, it was very interesting because this place called Mount Bachelor Academy that was actually making kids do lap dances as part of their treatment, which recently got shut down by the state of Oregon, they had claimed, that everything was professionally designed and it was all therapeutic and et cetera, et cetera. Turned out there was one licensed person on staff who didn't even see all the kids. And that place was charging $7,000 or, $6,500, something like that, a month. And it was actually getting funded from schools would send their kids there to treat ADHD. So they were getting federal education money spent on this complete nonsense.
Tell us about who these educational consultants are and what you've learned about them with your research.
Basically, they are people who will tell the parents, yes, we know that there's bad ones out there, but we can find you a good one. They are supposed to be experts at finding the right placement for your particular troubled child. The problem here is that there's no research that shows that anything of these work, so you can't even match anything by any kind of standard anyway. And they are not licensed. They don't have to have any kind of particular qualifications. And many of them have been found to take kickbacks. So basically, you call up the educational consultant and they say, oh, I've got the perfect place for your kid. And in this instance that was reported in congressional testimony, it was the husband referring to his wife's program. And of course, he did not disclose that he was married to this person. So, there's all kinds of issues with these consultants, and they get paid an enormous amount of money to do all kinds of tests, and, they appear to be professional. And some of them, have qualifications, and some of them do quite good work in terms of helping kids find colleges and stuff like this. But their connection with the, therapeutic schools has really been deeply problematic, and a lot of them are former employees of some of these places, so they just believe in the ideas that support them.
Going back to some of the stuff that goes on in some of these places, apparently, there have been a number of, and you've written about quite a few legal proceedings, and you've told us about a few of them. Is there any major one that might be pretty representative of the kinds of things parents should worry about that you want to tell us about?
Well, I mean, you can tell all the particular horror stories. For example, the story of Aaron Bacon, who slowly died over several weeks from a ulcer that could have been treated with an over-the-counter medication. He was in a wilderness program, and they, even as he lost control over his bodily functions and lost something like 30 pounds over a couple of weeks, they continued to claim that he was faking and continued to do things like take away his blanket so he had to sleep outside in sub-zero temperatures with a condition that ultimately killed him. And as he lay dying, they were making fun of him. So, you know, I mean, that's about as bad as it can get. You know, there's other cases where the lap dance place that I was just mentioning, they actually had girls who had been sexually abused, and they made them do lap dances for boys, supposedly as a way to show them what their future was going to be like if they continued to be sexually promiscuous. And they, you know, even if these girls may not have even actually been sexually promiscuous, but the idea was that, you know, they should be shamed for their role in choosing to have been abused. Because the bizarre thing about the philosophy of these places is that you are totally responsible for everything that happens to you. So, yes, if you got raped, you asked for it. And that is just so sick that people have a very hard time believing that that's indeed what is being conveyed, but it is.
My jaw is hitting the ground. It's just incredible. What sort of tips, you're obviously very knowledgeable about this, or suggestions, more specific suggestions, I guess, you've given us some general ones for parents who have teens, and let's again assume that we're maybe at the extreme of the continuum, that we're, I think it's pretty clear that if we're not at the extreme, that maybe just some individual therapy, perhaps family therapy would be indicated, but you know, you've got really out of control behavior, perhaps even being abusive towards the parents and so forth. What, what would you recommend?
Well, the research on this is that there's a type of treatment called multisystemic family therapy. Unfortunately, it's primarily available in the juvenile justice system, but they've studied that with families, and what happens there is the therapist actually comes into the home and helps the parent take control and helps the child find pleasurable activities that are not destructive. And, you know, this has been used with kids who are violent. And it has reduced, you know, recidivism and use of institutional settings and, you know, overall friction. So although it just sounds like, oh, it's too mild, you know, family therapy, that couldn't really work. The thing is that, like, you know, you can say, well, we tried this and it didn't work. You have to keep trying. There is no quick fix. And that's the problem here, because people are desperate for, you know, they want to go sort of up the ladder and find some intense solution for this really intense and difficult problem, and they want it, you know, to just be solved. And the problem is, for these extreme situations, this is something that has usually not just appeared in adolescence. Sort of severe behavior problems that appear in adolescence tend to resolve, you know, with time. But severe behavior problems that have started, you know, in infancy or toddlerhood, those are probably going to be lifelong mental illnesses. And that is something that nobody has an answer for. You know, this stuff can help. But, you know, it's a long, you know, and I wish I could say something, you know, oh, just do this or that, but it, you know, they're really, we really need a much better mental health system in this country, and we just don't have it.
And as I mentioned before, I highly recommend your book to folks. I'm going to put that on our blog so everybody can access that information. Can you recommend any other resources?
I'm just trying to think in terms of for parents.
Yeah, or even,
I mean, you know, for parents with, you know, genuinely mentally ill kids, the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill can be really helpful. For kids who have been through these places and are struggling and want to do something to help other kids, there's an organization called the Coalition for the Ethical Treatment of Youth, and they are great and, you know, help kids find each other and get over this experience and organized to help other people. There's also an organization that is called ASTART, which includes professionals and parents who have lost kids to these places, and they offer support. Both of these organizations are new and small and could really use more support, so I definitely recommend getting in touch with them. The good news is that most teenage problems are not on the severe end of the spectrum. And we all know kids who smoked pot every day through high school, went on to college, did fine. And then we all know a couple of them that did. And so it's, you know, it's one of those things where there really aren't easy answers. But the most important thing for almost all of this and for recovery in the long term for any kind of mental illness is family support and friend support, just social support in general. Because drugs, medication, therapy, all of that is great and probably essential in a lot of places and very helpful. But if people are going to have long-term recovery from anything, they need social support. So one of the best things you can do is just the most obvious, which is love your kids.
Well, Ms. Salovitz, I want to not only thank you for your time today, but I want to thank you for doing all this research and bringing this to the public's awareness.
Thank you.
Yes, I think you did just hear Maya Salovitz say drugs are important and perhaps essential. That presumably would have been the drugs with the happy, healthy, smiling people on the label, rather than drugs as in the war on drugs, or perhaps drugs as in Ritalin or other chemical coshes which are handed out to subdue children who are dangerously independent or dangerously uninterested in the corporate future mapped out in front of them. Perhaps they're not attentive to Bus Radio or Channel 1, or are otherwise marking themselves as underachievers. That's if we measure achievement in terms of compliance with someone else's agenda. Her concluding note that love and support by friends and family, in one sense obvious perhaps, but worth stating, because in a culture which says whatever the problem is, the answer is to spend money, buy a well-designed product, or call in the services of some experts. Something perhaps that previous generations could have taken for granted, but how can kids understand? Perhaps if they listen to John Taylor Gatto and note that a good education does not need to cost a lot of money. Now we've just got time for a little of Disciplined Minds. This is a fantastic book by Jeff Schmidt, which makes the point that what applies to schools also applies to postgraduate and professional training. All episodes of this book are available for download. I've compiled them. Just go to the website and type Disciplined Minds into the search box. Or follow the link from today's page. That's unwelcomeguest.net/540.
Disciplined Minds, a critical look at salaried professionals and the soul-battering system that shapes their lives, written by Jeff Schmidt in the year 2000. The first chapter, Timid Professionals. No two people are allowed to read the same thing, I said above the noise, gesturing toward the other passengers on the crowded subway car. My out-of-town visitor glanced around the clattering train. Indeed, the commuters hurtling toward their jobs in Manhattan's office buildings, restaurants, shops, and other workplaces were reading such a wide variety of material that my joke about held up. That typical weekday morning found writers engrossed in all kinds of magazines, paperback books, the Daily News, the Post, the Times, office documents, a software instruction book, and yes, the Bible. Those who weren't reading were listening to headphones, talking to others, or apparently just thinking. Seeing this every day on the subway set me up for a surprise one morning when I went to catch a suburban commuter train to Manhattan. I'd stayed overnight in Westchester County, an upscale New York City suburb where many executives and professionals live. I would be riding into the city with lawyers headed for big corporate law firms, financial analysts going to investment banks, editors bound for publishing conglomerates, as well as accountants, journalists, doctors, architects, engineers, public relations specialists, and a host of other professionals. Boarding the train felt something like entering a library. There were no conversations, even though nearly all of the seats were occupied. Almost everyone was reading, but the dozens of passengers were reading only two things, the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. I could have formulated another joke about allowed reading matter, but the scene was too spooky, like the aftermath of an invasion of the body snatchers. Everyone dressed the same, in suits, sitting silently in neat rows and columns, each holding up a large newspaper, absorbing the same information. A herd of independent minds? Something seemed very wrong with this picture. It was obvious that when the subway riders and the suburban train riders converged at the workplace, the people who showed the greatest diversity in their dress, behavior, and thought, the non-professionals, would be asked to do the least creative work, while the most regimented people would be assigned the creative tasks. This seemed just the opposite of what one might expect, and even more disturbingly, it indicated that people who do creative work are not necessarily independent thinkers.
Of course, regular listeners to the show will be aware of a wide variety of ecological reasons why society and life as we know it is going to be changing a lot, possibly very fast, or possibly without much warning. I hope this show has encouraged you to reflect on just how much most people's thinking is kept tightly within the box. And if you've never noted the perverse situation of why the most creative jobs in society are given to the least creative people, I hope that will help you start to understand the immense wastefulness of persisting with the current status quo. I don't think there's time to mention my father, a mathematics professor, who I'm sure will be glued to the cricket, but probably won't give this program a listen because it'll require too much thinking about. Now, we do have time for a Radio Free School interview of Dana Martin from January 2011 on radical unschooling, which is beyond schooling, affecting parenting and every aspect of life, to challenge hierarchical assumptions about the need to control.
Dana, you're a writer, also an inspirational speaker. You've made YouTube videos on radical unschooling, and you've got two books out, is that right?
Correct. One that's been out for over a year, and I have another being released this month.
Well, we'll talk a little bit about that later, but the concept of radical unschooling.
Okay.
And so what exactly is that? Because there's so many different groups and blogs and books. People are trying to understand what radical unschooling means. And would you say that one of the key words would be without coercion? Is that...
To understand radical unschooling, it's important to first understand unschooling. And unschooling is a method of homeschooling in which, you know, learning is really important to unschoolers, but they don't learn or believe in learning in the traditional sense that learning needs to be followed by a curriculum or that it needs to be forced, for example. Unschooling is really trust-based, that a child will learn what they need to learn in life. And it's really based in passions and interests being the nucleus of a child's learning, and that so much learning comes from exploring those. Now, radical unschooling is taking the same trust with education that people have with unschooling and incorporating it in other areas of their lives with their children. Some of the main areas are foods, media, bedtimes. It's a really overall trust of your child's choices. Now, traditionally, you know, as a culture, we live in an authoritarian paradigm where the parent has a really distinct role as the authority, and control is a really big part of it, you know, controlling what your children do and kind of giving permission and dictating what's done. And obedience is a really big focus of traditional parenting. Now, radical unschooling philosophy is living in a partnership paradigm rather than an authoritarian paradigm, which is really an evolution in parenting that's kind of exploding right now. It's becoming known in so many different realms of life. I can't even believe how many people are, there's blogs are exploding, you know, books are coming out left and right. This is really, really catching on. And I truly believe that a partnership paradigm is new. However, it's going to be really commonplace by the time I have grandchildren. It's going to be really accepted and viewed with respect, much in the same way that attachment parenting has become in the last decade.
And why do you think that is? Why do you think that there's this shift?
Well, I think people are seeing, I mean, professionals, doctors are seeing these enormous benefits that they never knew were there. You know, and in fact, when I had my son 12 years ago and I was pregnant, I started researching attachment parenting and learning about it and, you know, putting into practice a lot of the philosophy that I had believed in and always done but just never knew there was a label to. And everybody around me was telling me how wrong it was and how it's going to create these monster children and selfish, and they're never going to be able to sleep on their own. And, you know, all these kind of lies I was told never came to be. In fact, these children that have been raised, you know, for a decade, and people that have even been doing it a lot longer are realizing how amazingly secure and loving and, you know, kind to others that these children are becoming. And I think people are really rethinking their stance on that type of parenting.
Mm-hmm. So rather than, you know, the predicted children would become really self-centered or, you know, just doing whatever they want, you're seeing that that's not the case at all.
Exactly. In fact, quite the opposite is happening of what people were trying to dissuade me from doing. I think, you know, people were well-intentioned telling me, you know, these are family and friends who I'm referring to. Mm-hmm. I think people were well-intentioned trying to instill fear in me. But at the same time, I think it brought up a lot of deep issues for them because I think a lot of people, you know, really wanted to parent instinctually and nurture their child, but were told themselves not to. So, it's painful for them to see other people doing what they so deeply wanted to do but just didn't have the courage to do it because they wanted the approval of others. They wanted to be accepted by their mother-in-law or mother, and yeah.
It's very hard, I guess, to go against what you yourself have been raised as well as, like, if you've been raised that way. It's sometimes very hard for people to see that shift, so it does take courage, as you just said.
Exactly. And so the core philosophy of radical unschooling is something that I've lived from the beginning with my children. I've just always trusted them. And in the same way they learn to walk and talk, they've learned to read and write. It never, ever had to be forced. I never have had to sit my children down and bargain and coerce and bribe and threaten punishment for them to do workbook pages to learn how to read, for example. They have learned to read just through pursuing their passions, through living a life rich with the written word, through me facilitating their interests. And if you would have told me 10 years ago that this was possible, I probably wouldn't have believed you either. I wouldn't have believed anybody because I've never heard about this way of learning. And I just want to speak it from the mountaintops and tell people that this is possible. Mm-hmm. And it's really rewarding. And it's a much, much better way than through force or coercion.
Right. So yeah. I'm just thinking, though, that you find that you mentioned you have a 12-year-old now.
Yeah.
I find that that's a tricky age when kids who are unschooled reach. It's almost like they need to expand the boundaries. The limitations of the family. The family becomes not enough. Have you had that experience yet?
No, I haven't actually. I know it might be just individual for the child. You know, maybe one of my other children, as they hit that age, will go through that. But I think because just travel is really important to us and making connections is really important to us. So I think my children are really, Devin, my 12-year-old, is really fulfilled in that way. You know, he Skypes with kids, with friends from all over the world, and, they play computer games, and he went to his friend's house for the day yesterday. And I think if you stay in that partnership mode and just communicate, and if your child's wanting to do more, to make sure you facilitate that, mm-hmm. I think that's really important. So I think communication is key.
And again, it might be a different kind of, you have to be open to the fact that, they're going through a different period in their life. They're starting a new time. So their interests will not necessarily be the same as what they've been. And so it's evolving. That partnership that you're talking about continues to evolve. Right?
Exactly. And I have found that living this life, it's so beneficial because you know your children so well and you're able to meet their needs individually. Like my 9-year-old daughter is really social and she really likes to go out and do things very often, where Devin, my 12-year-old, he's really content being home. You know, he's kind of a homebody personality. And so with her, I really have to meet that need. You know, she'll wake up in the morning and say, where are we going today and what are we doing?
Mm-hmm.
And even if I feel like staying home that day, I think it's really important for me to help facilitate that. Whether, we'll talk about, here are the options of what we can do in our area today. We'll go online and research, if there's any cool things happening. And so again, I think it's really individual. And I'm so happy that, we have the freedom to meet each of our children's needs in that way where they are so different.
But doesn't it feel like you have to be their everything sometimes? Do you ever get that feeling? It's just a bit too much, or do you have to be their everything?
I don't feel that way. However, it is important for me to facilitate being their everything in that way. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I'm not the sole person to meet their needs, but I have to make sure that there's other resources to be able to meet them, whether it's family or friends.
So it's still really you. Like, I mean, people might say, unschooling is easy because you don't have to do anything much, right?
It's definitely not. Okay, I know what you're saying. Yeah, it's definitely not for the lazy parent, put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
At all. I'm busy living this life, I rarely sit down. I kind of joke around that I'm at home a lot, but I don't sit down often because, all at once, Devin could be asking me to research something and look something up with him and help. Then my other children are wanting the same need, wanting the same thing. And so I'm kind of bouncing back and forth. And at the same time.
So that's what I meant. Like, is it sometimes a bit overwhelming? Is it
sometimes,
too much?
Sometimes, but, most of the time it's really copable, but it all has to do with how I'm feeling that day. Like, if it's so important as an unschooling parent to take the responsibility to take your needs really seriously. You need to make sure you're well-rested and well-fed, because if I'm tired or hungry, it's much harder for me to facilitate everyone's needs. Mm-hmm. And I'm grumpier about it, you know, about like, oh, just give me a second, guys, or whatever is happening at the time. I have much less patience. So I think one of the most important things, advice I could give an unschooling parent, is to take the responsibility to meet your needs and meet them well. Because you need to have a full cup to live this life. You have to be overflowing and full to be able to give to others. If you're empty and you're drained, you have nothing to give, and your children really suffer from that. So it's very important to me to meet my own needs.
That's very helpful indeed, because I think many of us don't. We're always rushing around and being very busy and not taking care of our own selves. So.
And not only is it important to keep your cup full for your children in the way I described, but, I mean, what if I went through my life not meeting my needs? You know, if children learn what they live, how is that helping them? What am I showing them to do, to ignore their own needs and put the needs of others first before their own? And I don't want my children to grow up like that. I want them to know how important they are and how important meeting their needs are. So I'm doing this because it's important as a facilitator of their learning and interests in life, but for them too, to know. Because my mother was really kind of a martyr in that way. You know, she'd give till it hurts sometimes, and I kind of grew up modeling that, and it really took, you know, shifting in my mind to say, what's going wrong? You know, what's going on? And luckily I had a great support system to help me learn how to meet my own needs.
So how do you meet your own needs?
And it really is so individual according to what my interests are. You know, most recently I'm taking a pottery class, and that's for my own needs and interests. I think it's so important for my children to see that learning never ends, and that passions never end, and that part of being human and being on this earth is constantly evolving and growing and exploring. Mm-hmm. And so I love to attend classes that I'm interested in, you know, pottery class. I love to ski. We're skiing right when I'm done this interview, actually. We're going to go skiing as a family. Making sure I'm fed. Food is such a big deal that people overlook. It really is important to be well fed, regardless of what your diet is, you know, what your beliefs are surrounding food. To keep yourself well fed is the basis of so much, and also well rested. So I go to bed when my youngest goes to bed, and I wake up usually an hour or two before everybody else, so I can, you know, do what I want as far as, like, respond to emails. And most of my free time at home is spent supporting others. And that really fills my cup.
Wow. So I just wanted to go back a little bit to because what I'm noticing a lot of unschooling of your family, what you've just described, it's a family project in a way, like what you're doing. It's learning as a family. And how about that piece about learning in community? Do you get a chance to do any collaborations with other families? And a lot of literature coming out where they talk about how kids learn well together. And I don't mean in the school context, but just when they're bouncing off ideas with one another, you know, whether it's in front of the internet, researching together. And there's that element that I find, you know, I'm an unschooling mom too, and I've one daughter now. The other two decided to go off to school. But I have that concern that maybe there does need to be some more people to bounce off ideas and things like that. What do you say to that?
Well, I think for me, I know what you're saying, and I agree from the perspective of passion is infectious. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's important for me to surround my children with passionate people in life, people that love to learn, because passion, when I'm interested in something and I'm passionate about it, my kids, it's amazing how they really oftentimes they become interested too. Since the pottery class, they're like, wow, you know, I didn't think of this before. This looks really fun, and wow, does Mom love this, and I'd like to try this. And so I think from that group dynamic, it is like when you're surrounded by people that are passionate about what they're learning about, it is infectious. And so passion is very important. It comes from a lot of different sources. You know, my daughter, who's 9, thrives in group settings because she loves that passion's really awesome to her. And my son, however, prefers that kind of connection online with people. He's not so much the in-person kind of thing. So, again, it's knowing your child, knowing how they learn, and being able to meet that need. But passion is definitely a huge part of our life.
Well, that's the thing. Like, having that, I think that's, you know, we have to keep that exposure going, because that's so crucial to what unschooling is about. So being able to expose kids to that, those different people who are passionate about what they're doing, that's one of what, when I had the radio show, this is the interview part now, but we used to have, the children would come up with ideas, and they were always able to meet people that were incredibly passionate about what they were doing. And I think that was really exciting about that aspect, being able to be involved. I guess you could do that through communities as well. It doesn't necessarily have to be this kids the same age. That's a thing. But
you get in so many different ways, just in normal human interaction. You know, and one thing that I think some unschoolers overlook is, for some reason, the word teaching is really kind of taboo. People don't like to use the word teaching in unschooling. However, in the way I'm about to describe it, I think it can be really, really important. Have you ever heard that saying that you absorb a certain percentage of a topic from listening, and then another percentage from writing or speaking, and then but the best way to absorb what you're learning is to teach others?
Yeah.
Well, my children love to be in that role of helping other people learn something. Now, I'm planning a conference in New Hampshire, in the area where I live, in the White Mountains, this April. Mm-hmm. It's called the Life Rocks Conference. And my children have had so much fun helping plan the sessions for this that they can't wait to lead, you know, with all involving their passions. My daughter is doing an American Girl Doll session. You know, they're doing all these fun things that they're interested in. Now I know that they will learn so much even more deep, more meaningful to them by educating others about them. So that's something that isn't really focused on or it's really often overlooked, is helping your child be in that teacher role to others as a form of learning.
And, I mean, it happens sometimes with siblings, and the kids might appreciate it. Other times they don't. I know that, you know, don't tell me what to do.
Well, right. Well, siblings are a whole different conversation. Yes, yes.
I was looking at your site, and one of your quotes is that you can have it all. I wonder if it's difficult to sustain that, you know, that kind of feeling. It just seems like I would find it a pressure to have that. In the sense that it seems like an overwhelming thing to live up to. What do you have to say about that?
What all means is really individual to each family. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm referring to a lot of different perspectives of life. For one, I think it takes to lead a unschooling life or radical unschooling life, living in a partnership paradigm really takes living in an optimistic mindset. Mm. You know, it takes a real shift. It affects every area of your life when you're learning about this and learning to focus on all that's working in your life, learning to focus on the positive, you know, learning to see the good in people. You know, that's been very helpful on my path. And what I mean by you can have it all is that you can have connection and you can have friendship with your children. Mm. You know, we're told in our culture that I'm the parent, I'm not your friend. Mm-hmm. And so it's a big reference to you can have it all. You can have, you know, the family of your dreams in that way where you can be connected. It doesn't mean that there's not difficult times, but it's really focusing on all that you could have living this life that most people don't. You know, I have a lot of friends that, you know, that I grew up with or that I went to school with that I'm still in touch with, and seeing their relationship is very different with their children. It's very difficult. You know, the authoritarian paradigm, I just feel that it's really one-dimensional, where I think it's very, very deep living this life. You get to experience so much that a traditional parent doesn't.
Mm. It's amazing that that being friends with your children, that's kind of a theme that comes up a lot with unschooling parents and kids. I find that the connection continues into adulthood.
Right.
Kids that I've talked to, the grown unschoolers, they have good relationships with their, I mean, not saying everybody, obviously, but
right.
Overall, the dialogue continues, a love of their siblings, and that, I think that's, that's almost worth anything, really.
It is a real benefit to living this life, and it really feels like the life of my dreams, because I so deeply wanted that as a child. You know, and with a lot of adults in my life, I wanted to be taken seriously. I wanted them to look at me as an equal, and I never was, you know, and that was really hard. I think with my mother, I definitely was, in a lot of respect, you know, not in every relationship, but, like, with my father or, you know, with aunts, uncles, grandparents. Like, I just wanted to be able to be in on the conversation and have my opinion and what I was sharing be valued. Instead, I was brushed away so much, and I felt such an injustice, and I think I'm a really empathetic person just by nature, and I never wanted my children to feel that way. Like, from the beginning, I wanted them to feel value and that I cared about what they said and what they had to share. And we have the most amazing relationship that my kids can tell us anything.
Have your kids ever asked to go to school? And if they have, would you let them?
They have never asked, and they don't have any desire to right now, but if they ever wanted to, I would support that. I might have those gut, you know, wrenching feelings in my head of, oh my goodness, that's going to be so weird or different. But you know what, I have a really good friend our Devin and her son have been best friends since they were 2 years old, and he started school this year. He's going to a Montessori school, and it's totally by choice. Mm-hmm. You know, he's a really social boy and wanted to have a lot of friends, and it's really working for him. And so to me, this philosophy is about respecting their choices, and I think mm-hmm. school should be used as a resource like a library. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think it should be forced. I think the present system could be, you know, tweaked a little bit, to say the least, to accommodate people. But why couldn't school be a resource, like every other resource out there, that you could go to for a week if you wanted and try it out and take one course or whatever? But, no, I'm not, like, anti-school, and I would be supportive of him going. But my kids love the freedom of being home. And I think being an advocate and traveling the world like we have, they've seen so much, and they're really informed about schools. I don't think they would even know what to do if they were treated like kids in school are treated. My, you know, having to raise their hand to go to the bathroom, or it just is so foreign to them.
And I think the other thing about schooling is that it's not a process that's going to end when the children turn 18 or something.
Right.
We're thinking of it in terms of you're in it for the long haul, forever, until, you know.
Exactly, with your relationship and with learning in general, you know, it's something where, you know, you live this life and you're learning so much alongside of your children, just about yourself, and it's you're all learning together different things maybe, but you're growing together and learning together in the sense of, you know, what humans really are on Earth here to do, and it really expands to so much. You know, it makes you rethink everything when you've busted out of that box and you're parenting differently. You look at the world with totally different lenses than most people. You truly do. And sometimes I think it would be easier if I was just, you know, as a traditional parent, because, you know, you see the injustice sometimes and it hurts your heart. Because you're seeing things that most people don't look at it from that perspective. And sometimes I think I have a little bit more pain and empathy for, you know, children than most people. And sometimes you feel like you're on a different planet when you're in a group full of people that parent differently. And that kind of connects to your upbringing and the way that a lot of people felt in school as kind of an outsider. You know, it brings up a lot of emotions that you may have grown up with yourself of being, you might feel rejected or feel you don't fit in or all those kind of things. Sometimes walking this path, you do feel that because you're doing something so different. And you feel so normal and happy, you just can't see that other people can't see it. And I think a lot of times, you know, just talking to friends, it's hard to be viewed at as the weird one.
Yeah.
It is sometimes because you're like, I'm so normal, I'm nice. Like, why do these people think that of me? But it just comes with the territory. You have to have courage to live this life, mm-hmm. to know so deeply that what you're doing is right, that it doesn't matter what other people think. And so when I say, like, personal growth and learning, I think it just takes you to that, like, zen place of just having to find peace with who you are, and regardless of what other people say. But I think that really benefits our children, too, you know, to be able to see you doing that. When people say to me, or I hear, that unschooling is lazy, I just, my mind is blown, because I really know that they don't understand what it is, because so, it's the opposite of that.
You said everything so beautifully, really explained so much, and I've learned a lot from this as well.
Well,
do you have anything more that you'd like to add?
Well, I'll just share that my book, Radical Unschooling, A Revolution Has Begun, you can find it in your local bookstore. I have another book coming out, which is a kind of what I call a coffee table book for, you know, mindful parents that are, you know, looking for inspiration. I know walking this path myself, it would have been so great to just have a book to pick up and read a quote really quick to, like, help myself feel better in that moment. And, you know, I think people need support. And so I wanted to offer a really new, unique form of support for unschoolers in the form of quotes and really positive images. My husband's a photographer, and the book is half his photos, which are really awesome, I think. I'm a little biased, but I'm so happy for him pursuing this passion that he has. And so it's really cool photos coupled with, you know, 100-plus original quotes of mine that are hoping to really inspire and support others on their path, and that's coming out in a couple weeks. So,
wonderful. And what's the book called?
True Freedom, Inspiration for Radical Parents. That, and I'm doing a conference, which is a new adventure. My husband and I, well, I traveled. I spoke at the first ever unschooling conference in London, and then this past year, the first ever unschooling conference in Australia, which was amazing. And so we travel a lot attending conferences, and this year we are doing our own conference in North Conway, New Hampshire, and it's called the Life Rocks Conference. So if you type in liferocksconference.com, you can read more about that, and it's at a really cool water park. And so that's a new adventure for our family, too.
This and All previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests are available for download as MP3s from unwelcomeguests.net/archive. There's a mailing list at altruists.org/unwelcome for any discussion relevant to the show. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Keep giving all you can.